Coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 on Hometown Heroes. Four brothers from Wyoming went off to war. Only three came home. Hear the twist of fate that brought one to California. And the discovery in the Philippines that made his work in cryptanalysis much, much easier.
Well, look down, and there was a codebook that didn't burn.
He sure doesn't sound 94, but he is. Don't miss his story on Hometown Heroes. Brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country. Sunday, 5 p.m. here on 1430.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories of the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained, oftentimes inspired, and I know all three of those are going to be true today as we visit with 94-year-old Jack Leonard of Clovis, California. Now, I say 94 only because I know you're not going to believe he's 94 when you hear him speak. But let's go way back to the beginning. Growing up in Casper, Wyoming, you had three brothers and one sister, and I bet you had a good jacket because it gets cold in Casper, Wyoming. What was your childhood like back there?
Well, it was cold. About the only thing you can say about it, it was cold. We looked forward to summer. We had summer one year in July. On the 4th of July, we had summer. But we just went to school there and just lived. But in 1939, got 42 below zero. And I told my mother, I said, you know, Mom, no white men and darn few Indians can survive in this climate. I'm going to find me a warm climate. And in 1940, I joined the service.
So this is far before Pearl Harbor. You had already graduated from high school. Were you thinking that the military was going to be a career for you, or what kind of ambitions did you have?
My ambitions were few. I didn't have any ambitions, really. I didn't know anything. I just had a high school education. I got encouraged to enlist in the service because the two senators from Wyoming were in Fort Washakie, Wyoming, and I happened to be there at the time teaching the drum and bugle corps. And we rode around the lake, Fort Washakie, while they were fishing, and they were talking, Senator Joe Mahoney and Harry Schwartz. And Harry Schwartz's daughter and I went to school together, high school together. So anyhow, they were saying about what Roosevelt was going to do, what he was going to do, that he was going to get the draft and all that. Then they started talking to me. And they said, what are you going to do? And I had no opinion what I was going to do. I had this job teaching the Indian Drum and Bugle Corps, didn't know where I was going to go from there. But they said, well, they would suggest that I join the service because there's going to be a selective service. And you'll be on the ground floor and you'll get promoted faster. So that was my encouragement to join the service. I didn't know where I was going to go from there, but I joined the service.
And I bet you had no idea what kind of work you were going to do in the military either.
None whatsoever. I was lucky to be enlisted in the Army Air Corps, which was fine for me. I didn't want to be a foot soldier, but I did enjoy the Army Air Corps.
And just about every veteran who I've interviewed who was in the Army Air Corps in World War II tells me that he went into that branch of the service because he wanted to be a pilot. Your older brother was a pilot, a fighter pilot in World War II. Did you have those ideas that you might be in the cockpit?
I did, but I had a couple of problems. I'm deaf in one ear, and I'm blind. And they didn't take pilots that had to wear glasses. Then they had to hear also.
And let's clarify, when you say you're blind, that can give people a lot of different ideas. How impaired was your vision?
I was 20/20 in one eye and 20/200 in the other, and I was legally blind. But I had glasses about the size of a quarter inch on the side and paper thin in the middle, so I could see. I didn't get them until I was 8 years old. I saw a whole world that I hadn't seen before. I thought everybody saw the way I did until I got glasses. Then I realized there was a whole world out there.
And you would see a lot of that world in World War II, but the first place you saw, I guess, was
Moffett Field. At that time, Moffett Field had been taken over by the Air Corps as a fighter pilot training base, and that was where they were training radio operators for the Army Air Corps. And I started out to be a radio operator, learning the Morse code and learning to function on a bug and then do radio code.
Moffett Field was in the news recently because Google bought those big blimp hangars and a lot of that facility from the government. So we'll see what they're doing with it. Did they have those giant lighter-than-air blimp hangars there when you were there?
Oh, yes. That's where the offices alongside of the hangar were where we had our training schools. One day, I recall, I was listening to the radio, and all at once I heard this horrible noise. Both ends of the big dirigible hangar was open, and a fighter pilot, flew through the hangar. Leave us say he was no longer in the Air Corps. But anyhow, it was really something to hear the noise of it going through a closed building like that.
Wow. I wonder if that's the only time that ever happened.
I don't have any idea whether that was the truth or not, but I know it happened while I was there.
Wow, yeah. And anyone that's ever seen those blimp hangars, and you can find a picture online real easy, Moffett Field in the Bay Area of California, there's not a lot of space those are big doors. The 49ers used to send their punters in there to kick so they could simulate punting in a dome. But there's not a lot of leeway on either side for a plane to go through that whole thing.
Yeah, but the fighter pilots in those days was very, very small. They weren't very big. They would probably only had a wingspan of, I wouldn't say more than 100 feet, if that wasn't that much. So they could go through there quite easily.
And I could see how that sound would stick with you for a while. As far as the training that you had there, what kinds of things were you learning? And was it challenging for you, or was it a piece of cake?
I think it was a piece of cake to me because I enjoyed what I was doing. I was learning Morse code, dit, dot, dot, and learning to type on a mill, which is a typewriter that's just all capital letters, and it's for typing. And when you're copying code, Morse code, you copy it in sections of four characters, five characters, and a space. And so I learned to do that, and it was very interesting. But along the way, they decided they were forming a new cadre up in Tacoma, Washington, at McCord Field. I was selected to go there with a group of about seven of us to form a new cadre for a new Signal Corps company. And they needed someone that could type, and so they promoted me from a private to a corporal and made me company clerk. And this was in September of 1940. So what the senators had told me, I get in on the ground floor, I got in on the ground floor.
I guess you did, and you just said September of 1940, so this is still more than a year before America ended up in the war. Did you have a sense that war was coming? Did you foresee things changing, or did you think, hey, this is just going to be fun, I'm going to be a clerk, I'm going to do this, and this is a good job?
I thought it was such a good job. I didn't think anything about war. Had no indication that it was going to be anything about it at all. We didn't get any news until 1941.
Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in Portland, Oregon. There was the Portland Army Air Base. Where the Portland Airport is now was Portland Army Air Base. I was there for quite some time. I got there in May of 41, and I stayed there until I went to OCS, Officer Candidate School in New Jersey, in October of 42. I was a signal office sergeant in charge of the signal office at Portland Army Air Base.
So December 7th, 41, you're in Portland, Oregon. How did you hear the news? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, being a sergeant, I had my own room in the barracks. Early that Sunday morning, a couple of guys banged on my door and said, "Sergeant, the Japs have just bombed Pearl Harbor." So I had to leave. There were only two of us that could work the code machines. Everything was encoded, then encrypted. And there were only two of us that could work it. It was my commanding officer and myself. I left my barracks and went to the signal office. And I was there 72 hours without sleep. And I went to sleep sitting at a teletype machine 72 hours later. But the only two of us, my commanding, he had other things to do. So that left me to do the encrypting.
And you say that very matter-of-factly, but hopefully people at home are hearing that and saying 72 hours, that's 3 days without sleeping a wink. What did that do to you emotionally or to your mindset to have all of a sudden, wow, we're at war? I'm sure you're imagining all kinds of possibilities in your own mind.
Well, all I thought about, we had a job to do. That was about it. I didn't think. We were so busy, the adrenaline was going. You didn't think about what's happening or where you were going or what's going to happen to you. All you thought about was the job that you were there to do at the time, and we did it. That's all we felt.
And you mentioned using those code machines and that the communications were done in code. And I have to think most people today have no idea what you're talking about, have never seen one of these code machines or would have no clue how they would work. How complicated was this, and how did you operate those?
The code machines were a cylinder of letters and numbers, and it was probably about 8 inches long, about 2 inches round. We would have certain code for the day to what we would use, and then we'd use a code book, like A would be E. E would be something else, and those would be your codes for the day. So when you're encoding, if someone wanted to say move squadron so-and-so with so-and-so there, well, you'd have to put it into language that no one could read, which would be coded. Like the squadron might be spelled XYZPQ, you know.
Sure.
That could be squadron. And that's what's a code machine. So we'd get those letters. We'd get the communication in our office. We'd have to decode it. And before we send anything out from the general, we'd have to encode it.
And were you allowed to tell anyone about what it was you were doing or any of that stuff that you just told me? Would you have been able to tell your family that or your brother that or your friend that?
No, we didn't say anything. We were high security.
So then you got that opportunity to go to officer candidate school, and you took them up on that. Did your activities intensify because there was a war going on now, or did you feel more of an urgency to what you were doing?
Well, I did. I went to many schools. I went to teletypewriter repair school. I went to maintenance of telephone central offices. I learned how to manage mess halls, restaurants, really. And then when I went to OCS, I was pretty much Army. All I had was Air Corps. I didn't know anything else in my life but the Air Corps. And so I thought that would be where I was going to go from there. And so from OCS, my first assignment as a commissioned officer was going to be a teacher, an instructor in administration at Fort Monmouth. I was going to be one of the teachers there. But the day before graduation, they called three officers' names up from the platform. They were having a confrontation of all the officers are leaving graduation. They said, these three officers' orders have been changed. And my orders were changed. Mine was the first ones changed. Lieutenant Jack Leonard was going to be assigned to Camp Pinedale, Fresno, California. In January of 1943, I landed in Fresno, California, in Camp Pinedale.
That was a pretty fateful change of orders, as we're going to find out. But if they hadn't been changed, what would have happened to you? What do you think your life would have been like?
I really don't know, because then I would have stayed at Fort Monmouth as a teacher. And as a teacher, I don't know what would have happened to me, how long I would have stayed there, or whether we would have found a combat unit to go to. I don't have any idea. All I know is I was sent out here to join a combat unit. So when I say a combat unit, supporting the combat soldiers, not a combat unit. We did the support. We were a single corps. We would copy the radio transfer, Japan radio. I knew it was Japan. We would encode it for do the best we could. I was sent to Washington, D.C. to intelligence school, where I learned cryptography, cryptanalysis, and I studied Japanese.
And I bring up, I'm probing that statement about the change of orders, because I know that if you hadn't been sent to Fresno, you never would have met a young lady who just turned 90 years old and you've been married to for 70 years. I guess that was a pretty fateful assignment, huh?
I'll tell you, it was the best assignment I ever had in my life. I have to tell you about that. We had a big bond drive at Camp Pinedale in 1943, in September 43. Well, on September 30th, they had a big, big ball for the bonds, for war bonds. They war bonds during World War II. That's the way they financed the war, was war bonds. Anyhow, my squadron sold the most war bonds. So our team were going to escort the Queen and her court to the ball that night. Officers weren't invited, only enlisted men. So Maxine was my wife now, was the Queen. So I called her up. I asked her if I was raffling off about 50 war bonds. So I called her up and I asked her if she'd come down to my office and pull the raffle and meet the sergeant that was going to be her escort for the ball. And so she very, very accommodatingly said yes. Well, when she walked in the door, here I am, a smart aleck, second lieutenant, hat in the back of my head, dark glasses on in my office, my feet on the desk. She comes to the door. I said, she's mine. And to myself, I said, she's mine. And my hat, glasses came off, my feet go on the floor, and we did the bond rally. Took me about 10 days to get nerve enough to ask her for a date.
Because, as you said, this was for all the enlisted men, so you didn't actually go to this ball that she was going to be presiding over. But you built up the nerve to call her up and arrange another meeting, huh?
I did, and we went out to dinner and a movie. And when I dropped her off at the home that night, I said, will you marry me?
First date.
Uh-huh. And she said, you can't be serious. I said, I am serious. Well, a year later, we were married. And it was the best move I ever had. And you know what? God found her for me, and God placed me here at that time. That's the only thing I can attribute it to, because she was mine the minute I saw her.
And she still is 70 years later, but don't you think we should get her side of the story, at least of how they met? I think we should, and we're going to do that when we come back. If you want to see what Jack and Maxine Leonard looked like then and what they look like now. Punch in Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. We'll hear from Maxine when we come back and find out what Jack was up to once he went overseas in the Pacific during World War II. Before we're done, we'll also hear about Jack's older brother who did not come home from the war and the perspective that produces for Jack. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with one of the sharpest 94-year-olds you're going to find anywhere. Can't you just hear the enthusiasm and the energy in his voice as Jack Leonard describes events that unfolded 70 years ago or even longer? When we left off, he told us about the way he met his wife, Maxine, that when the teenaged war bond drive queen walked through the door of his office at Camp Pinedale, he knew she was his. How he worked up the nerve to ask her for a date, and then when he took her home from their first date, he asked her to marry him. Pretty bold guy, huh? We don't get to do this too often, but let's get Maxine's side of the story. What were you thinking when you saw him sitting behind that desk, as he said, with his dark glasses on and his hat on the back of his head?
I thought he was kind of cute, but nothing more than that.
And you were just a teenager. I'm sure you weren't even thinking about marriage.
No, not at all. I had lots of time ahead of me.
What do you remember about that first date? Do you remember what movie you saw?
I should, but I don't. I know we went to the Fresno Hotel and had stuffed tomato salad for dinner, and I had my first taxi cab ride.
And maybe you can give us a sense. I know you've lived here your whole life, but I'm sure Fresno was a little different back then. And here you are, a teenage girl in Fresno, and there were guys in uniform crawling over all over town. It's not like that anymore. What can you tell us about that scene at that time?
Well, there were just a lot of soldiers and a lot of, we only had one downtown. There was no shopping centers, and everything was downtown on Fulton Avenue. So you could go downtown and you could see a lot of your friends and lots of soldiers. And it was kind of fun flirting with them. But we didn't do anything. I think there were a lot of USO drives and dances and whatnot that they had, but I was not allowed to go.
But you were allowed to participate in this war bond drive. Did you feel like that was your way of helping what was going on across the country?
Mm-hmm. I was going out to Fresno State at the time, and I took a summer a part-time job or a job for the summer with civil service, and I continued working because it was fun to make the money. And yes, we had the bond drive, and I sold more than anyone else, and I did feel like I was doing my part, was doing what I could.
So you have this first date with you, and at the conclusion he says, "Will you marry me?" How many shades of red did your face turn in that moment?
I was scared to death. I'd never had anything like that happen to me, and I was not ready to get married.
What changed your mind? What convinced you that, you know what, this guy's all right, and I guess I'll go for it?
Well, we were standing at the door getting ready to say goodnight at the port of embarkation where I had gone up to say goodbye to him a year later after we'd gone together a year. And we were saying goodnight, and I guess we decided to get married the next day. This was on a Friday night, and we decided we'd get married on Saturday. So we got married on Saturday, the day after he convinced me.
Was that a little scary for you to see this guy that you just married heading overseas?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I thought it was the end of the world, and people would tell me, well, you know, you'll eventually see that it, you know, it's just something that happens. But it was a scary thing. It really was. We had 6 weeks between us from communication, knowing what each other was doing. There was 6 weeks.
It took 6 weeks for a letter to get there.
Mm-hmm. And there was no, I don't think there was air mail, or maybe it was all air mail. But anyway, there was 6 weeks between communication. And he was gone 13 months and came home, and we just have had a nice life since then.
Did you always believe that he would be coming home? Did you experience concern, fear, you know, that he might not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. With that 6 weeks, you never knew what was going to happen or what was happening in that period of time.
How would you describe those 13 months for you and how you lived day to day, what your outlook was, or maybe what kept you believing that things were going to work out?
Well, I was working at Camp Pinedale where I had met him, and I continued to work. I was with civil service, and we were very, very busy, and we just passed the time and hoped that everything would turn out all right.
I don't want to blow your cover here, but you just celebrated your 90th birthday, and you had a family from all over come and surprise you for it, and you guys have been married 70 years now. I'm sure some of your kids and grandkids are thinking, it would be great to be married 70 years. What's the secret to a marriage that lasts that long?
He's still in training, so we never know from one day to the next. 70 years isn't long enough to get him in shape, but I'm working on it.
So you just keep giving him something to shoot for, and that's what keeps you guys going?
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing is try to be kind to each other all the time. That's one of the best things I can say to anyone starting out is try to be kind. Not try to be kind, be kind.
There's one thing more that made us stay together for 17 years. Yeah. We both believe in God. And 70 years ago, we made a vow to each other before God, until death us do part. We believed in that vow, and it's kept us together for 70 years. And it's God's will that we're together.
And apparently he's got a lot of work left for you, because Maxine just told us you're still in training. So let's hop back in the time machine to when you went overseas and said goodbye to that young lady you'd been married to for all of 6 weeks. Did you know where you were going or what you were going to be doing?
I knew where we were going and what we were going to be doing. I knew we were going to start in New Guinea. I knew we were going, that's where we were going. And I knew we were going to set up our radio stations, our radio receivers, and we were going to go to work, copy as much Japanese code as we could, and see as much information as we could get. And I knew where we were going. We started in Finchhaven. We were there just a day. We went to Hollandia. We were there for about 4 days. And then we went to the island of Morotai. And the island of Morotai was a bomber pilot training base, not training base, where the bombers flew out bombing Borneo. The Japanese, we'd set our clocks by them. 11 o'clock every night, they'd bomb the airport, airstrip. They were very accurate. They didn't bomb the personnel locations where we were sleeping, but they bombed the airstrip. But at 11 o'clock every night, except on Christmas night. Christmas night, they surprised us. They came over at 9 o'clock, and we were at a movie. From the movie to where we had our tents, the officers' row of our squadron, there was a big quagmire of mud where the trucks had all turned the corners, and we always walked around it. Well, a friend of mine, we palled around, played volleyball and whatnot. Anyhow, we took off, and we were running for our foxholes because we wanted to get there, because AK-AK would come down. It wasn't the bombs we were worried about. We were about the falling AK-AK. Instead of going around the quagmire, we went through it. Well, Mo, he fell down, rolled over, and got up, and I didn't gain an inch on him. we were just headed for when we got to our tent, and we had in our tents, we had our own foxholes. We dug them when we got there. I was there until February of 45, when I was sent to Palawan. A detachment of our squadron, we went to with the 13th Fighter Command, which was on the island of Palawan, the westernmost island of the Philippines. And we were the radio squadron to be there. And we were about 5 miles out from headquarters, because that's where we could get the best radio reception. So we set up for about a month. After we got there, no other planes could land, because this airstrip wasn't ready, but they finally got it ready. But while we were there, we were fortunate enough that my sergeant and I, he was a Tennessee squirrel hunter. He liked to shoot the baboons and the monkeys in the trees in the Philippines. So then we were walking through the forest one day, and here was a Japanese fire where they'd burned their information. Well, looked down, and there was a code book that didn't burn. So we had the Japanese code book. So I got in a B-25 and flew to Manila and gave it to headquarters. And all we had to do then, from then on, made it much easier. From then on, all we had to do was break the code for the day, the encoded, the first code, and everything from then on just fell to pieces.
Well, let's back up a little bit, and let's talk about what your work was like before you found that code book. So you would receive Japanese radio transmissions?
Radio code, Morse code. The radio operators would copy it, and then they would hand me the prints, all the words that they copied. All was in five units, five characters, and it was all in Romaji. It was all Roman characters, but it was in Japanese language. And I would break it down from the code that they had into what I considered was Japanese, good Japanese, and they would translate it.
So you had working under you how many men?
I had 11 Nisei, and I had 12 other guys, but 11 Nisei, they were all radio operators, except two of them were cooks.
So these 11 guys, they're all Japanese-American, born an American, but of Japanese descent, and I imagine many or all of them had families who were probably in internment camps back home. Did they ever discuss that with you?
No, we didn't. We didn't ever discuss it with us at all. They were happy to be with us. They were happy to be in the service, and they were happy to, they that's just one thing. They asked if they could have their meals separate because they didn't want to eat the rations the way we were. They wanted to cook them differently. And so I said, sure, go ahead. So no, there was no discrimination or difference. Right. They were just soldiers. Except they were Japanese.
Well, and they had the knowledge of the Japanese language, so that was helpful to you and the work that you were doing. Finding out later the reality of those internment camps and that so many of them were fighting for the very country that had their families basically locked up, did that give you a greater respect or admiration for the kind of people they were and the work that they did with you?
No, I respected them, the ones that I worked with. But as far as I was concerned, I called them Japs then. And I had an extreme dislike for them. I wanted nothing to do with them, here, there, or any place else.
Because of Pearl Harbor?
Because of Pearl Harbor. And because they brought us into a war. And I just felt that way until 1993. We got the opportunity to go to Japan on a sister city program, Konami and Kerman. And I didn't want to go because I still had this strong anti-Japanese feeling. And when we got to Konami, we stayed with one family for 3 days and another family for 3 days. Well, the second couple we stayed with were very close friends. We correspond by email. They send us Christmas cards. We send them Christmas packages. And they've been by to visit us 6 times. And me, who had a violent dislike for Japanese, they're the closest friends we've ever had. We've traveled the world and done many, many places and never corresponded with anyone except this Japanese couple. And they've become very close friends.
Was there a moment that everything changed for you? What do you think made that difference? Because that's one extreme to the other there.
Well, I think it was God just touched me. When it first started to change, we were in the Ginza district of Tokyo, and it's a very elite place. And our bus broke down. They were going to pick us up and take us to Konami. So they had to get us on a train and get us to Kamakura, where the big Buddha was. So I looked over in the corner of the train station, and here is the committee. 7 people making arrangements to transport 29 Americans from Tokyo to Kamakura on the train. Well, I watched them talking. Oh, they're so animated. Just watching them talking and moving their hands and everything, it just kind of tickled me. It tickled me. And I think the Lord says, hey, they're good people. So I started changing then at the station. And everything turned, it was so warm. Everything was so light and so warm and so friendly that you couldn't help but look. Couldn't help but like them. And they just changed. I did.
And I'm glad that you shared that because I know you're not alone as someone who carried that dislike or that hatred for understandable reasons, the way the world was then and the way America was attacked. But being able to go now 20 years with this newfound appreciation and forgiveness, if you will, or affinity for the Japanese people, do you feel like a burden has been lifted? I mean, how would you describe the difference between how you felt before and how you feel now?
Well, I just come to recognize that the Japanese are no different than we are. They're people just as we are. They have the same feelings that we have. They feel a little differently about different things, but they still have feelings. They love, they hate, they do work, they do everything else. They're just like us. They just have a different color and a different language. That's about it.
Well, I know we're bouncing around from different eras here, back and forth, and I had asked you what it was like before you found that code book. So now let me follow up you guys have that code book, and what a serendipitous find that is in the embers of a fire to find an intact code book that saves you so much work. How different were things after you had that code book? How much work did it save you, and what kind of strategic difference do you think it made?
I don't know if it made any strategic difference, but it made our job a heck of a lot easier, because when once we determined the first code, well, then all we had to take then was just take the Romaji and have our Japanese soldiers, our Nisei, translate it. That's all we had to do. It was simple. And then we didn't have much Japanese to copy. They were so busy in Okinawa, other parts of the country, that we didn't have much. So they sent me to Brisbane, Australia on a wrist leaf.
And as far as all these codes that you did intercept and that you did pass on, did you ever get a sense of what the content of some of those transmissions were? I mean, were we talking about troop movements or where things were going to be positioned, or what do you think those transmissions were about?
Well, I know some of them were from pilot to pilot, and they were about where they were going, whether they were going to Borneo, whether they were going to Okinawa, where they're going to go, whether they're going to come to the Philippines again. But we found out where they would, if there was a Navy ship they were going to go after, we would discover that they were going after a Navy ship, but we wouldn't know the Navy ship, we wouldn't know the name of it. But in Japanese, we would know that they were flying to bomb something and try to guess where they were going.
And as far as being in harm's way, I mean, you described the bombings on Morotai that you could count on like clockwork, and how they came early on Christmas. But even there at Palawan, were there times where you felt like your life was in danger or some danger was going to come your way?
Only once. Our radio receiving set, our trailer, was probably about 150 feet from my headquarters office, where I sat and did my work. Well, this one day I was sacked out, taking it easy because there wasn't anything to do. And a Japanese soldier, an enemy, took his gun, it was a 25 caliber, I think, and shot the operator, Sadar Nisei, and it went through his back and knocked off the end of three of his fingers. And, well, of course, when I first heard the guns, I took off and got my boots on and went out there. He turned around and emptied his clip into the office. Had I been sitting in my chair, he would have shot me. I would have got shot too. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there's no one there to get any shot. So I grabbed the sofa pads and put them on the front and back, got in the back of the Jeep and had the sergeant drive me to the hospital. And
yeah, so you took care of that wounded man under your command, knowing that you too could have been wounded or killed if you'd been in your office. It's a pretty sobering thought, but there's a funny twist to that whole story too, and we're going to save that for right after this break when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our candid and enlightening conversation today with 94-year-old World War II Army Air Corps veteran Jack Leonard of Clovis, California, originally from Casper, Wyoming, where he grew up as the son of Polish immigrants. Jack and his three brothers all served in World War II. We've heard how a change in assignment sent him to Camp Pinedale in Fresno, where he met his wife of 70 years. We even heard a little bit from her, and I wish we would have recorded the interview that Jack's son Scott did with him in front of high school and junior high students at Fresno Christian. I do have a link at hometownheroesradio.com to the coverage of that event by Fresno Christian's award-winning online newspaper, The Feather. Check that out. The bond, though, between father and son, the mutual love and respect that they have is so impressive, so palpable. And Scott did a better job interviewing his dad than I ever could. Scott wouldn't be here. He and his three brothers would have never been born if Jack didn't come home from the war. You can say the same for Jack and Maxine's 9 grandkids and their 5 great-granddaughters. When we left off, Jack told us about the day a Japanese soldier found his way into their outpost, actually fired shots into the office that Jack would have normally occupied, but also shot and wounded one of the Nisei soldiers, the Japanese Americans under Jack's command. You said you applied first aid and you rushed him to the hospital, and as it turned out, he lost a whole lot of blood. Why don't you pick up the story right there?
He had to have a transfusion. All the Nisei wanted to give him their blood, but I was a commanding officer. And I had the same type of blood. So someplace in Minneapolis, there's a Japanese family that has a pint of Polish blood in them.
Well, that's a great story. And I'm sure every time you tell it, you get the same kind of reaction. People don't see that coming. Where were you when World War II came to an end? When you found out, hey, this is all over, our side won, and I get to go home and see if that young lady I was married to for a few weeks is still there.
Well, as I said, I was down in Brisbane on a rest leave. And the day before the war ended, we were at the air base ready to take off, and our plane developed engine trouble. So we couldn't take off until the next day. Well, my 21 men wanted to stay there. Then we didn't want to go to the barracks. They wanted to go downtown and have a free night because we're going back to the war. And I said, okay, if you'll be here at 7:30 in the morning, I'll let you go. And I went to the officer's quarters and got my room back and sacked out. Well, that night the war ended. And when the war ended, I thought, well, I wonder who's going to show up. Who's going to show up in the morning, because Brisbane went just like San Francisco and every place else in the world, went just hog wild. In the morning when I got to the airbase at 7:30, or it was out by 7:29 when I got there in the Jeep, 21 guys were lined up waiting for me. They were ready to go home. We had to fly back to Leyte, where our headquarters was. We had to stop at Biak, the island of Biak, for that was the airbase. We had to stop the fuel. Well, we had a heck of a time trying to land at Biak because they were shooting off AK-AK, the tracers, celebrating the end of the war. So they had to finally get them to stop shooting so we could land and get gas. But we got back, and from then on, we played a lot of gin, a lot of bridge, a lot of poker, and just waited until we got home. I'd been in the service from 1940, so I had quite a few points, so I got out. I left Manila in November of the 30th, 1945.
And what do you remember about being back home in California and seeing your bride again?
Well, I was out of my mind. I'm where I belong. But here I am. I have no talent. I'm 6 years in the service. And how good is cryptanalysis in civilian life? Maxine's father was a general contractor. While I was overseas, they bought a lot. And first thing we had to do was build a house. Well, I couldn't even hold a hammer. I didn't know how to hold a hammer. Well, he taught me how to hold a hammer, and I was a carpenter. And I worked as a carpenter, worked with him, and built a house. And now I had to do a job, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew I didn't want to be a carpenter. Her father thought maybe he could bring me along and go into the business with him, but I didn't think I would suited for that. He didn't either, after he knew me long. And I took a aptitude test. Minnesota Mutual gave aptitude tests. Well, being that I had no training except military, it was just aptitude based on personality. Well, it came back, and the operator, or the agent for Minnesota Mutual, called me in and said, we got your test back. It came back very good. You're very good at mathematics, and you're very good at analysis. But you want to get a job where you don't deal with people, because you don't like people at all. And definitely don't want, he was looking for salesmen. But at the same time, he did say that they're hiring temporary people at Producers Cotton Oil Company. Well, I went down and applied, and I got the job as a temporary clerk. I reported to work one morning, and I never worked as a temporary clerk, because a young man that had a job that happened to be the superintendent of sales and shipping for the mill department of Producers Cotton Oil Company had quit. And the secretary, treasurer, office manager of the company said he thought I could fit that job, and it would be a permanent job. So I didn't know what I was going to do, but I found out that I'm in sales. And I was told not to be in sales.
Right. You're not a people person.
I'm not a people person. The first person that people walked into the office, as they saw besides the switchboard operator, was me, because I was right at the front door. Anyhow, I stayed with him for 18 years, and then I decided to become an attorney.
God always has a plan, and he has a sense of humor, I guess, too, huh?
I guess he does. I always ask him every morning, what does he want me to do? And he doesn't tell me anything. But at nighttime, I say, thank you. I'll see you tomorrow morning. I thank you for the day.
I want to ask you before I forget. We mentioned earlier that you were one of four brothers who all served in World War II. What were your other brothers doing during the war? And did you ever have any idea of what they were up to?
One underneath me, the only one still surviving, he was in the Navy. The two younger ones were enlisted men in the Navy. My oldest brother was a fighter pilot, and he was killed in just 3 days before the war ended in Europe, in Italy. And the other two, one is 4 years younger than me and 6 years younger than me, they were both in the Navy. And one was a quartermaster, and the other one was a clerk on a APA. But they were both in the Navy, and they were both enlisted, and my brother and I were both in the Air Corps.
And you just mentioned what happened to your older brother, Raymond. When did you find out about that he had been killed just a few days before the war in Europe was over?
I got a letter from my sister-in-law, his wife. I was in Brisbane. I probably got the letter he was killed in May. I probably got the letter end of June, the 1st of July. It took a long time to get him, and she told me about it.
What did that feel like? How devastating was that for you?
Well, my brother and I were fairly close. We were only a year and 9 months apart. We were only a year apart in school, and he was my idol. I wanted to do everything he did. So it was quite devastating to me at the time. I realized what he was doing, but it was going to happen. But why did it have to happen to him? Why did God pick him? But God picked a lot of people. But it was pretty devastating to lose someone. I felt sorry for myself. I lost my brother.
The way I understand it, you had an opportunity this last year to visit Washington, D.C. and the National World War II Memorial. Your son, Scott, went with you. And as part of that tour, you guys were looking at a particular airplane at a particular museum. And it just so happened that there was a connection between that plane and your brother's service in World War II. And you didn't find that out until that trip? Tell me how that all unfolded.
Oh, we knew before the trip. We knew about what he had done. We knew that he was one of the first to shoot down a German jet. I knew that. My sister-in-law told me that. Uh-huh. He went to a command conference in Rome and knew that he was a good fighter pilot. And he did his share.
And I know you learned the circumstances of his death, that on a mission to hit the Ploiesti oil fields in Romania, his P-51 was hit. His wingmen warned him not to bail out because he was too close to the ground, but he tried to, and his chute never opened. But while you're in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight, you happen to see something that you hadn't seen before, thanks to your son, your nephew, and some technology perhaps a little more advanced than those little cylindrical code machines you were using during World War II.
Got a picture of the Italian paper. I have a picture of my brother and four other, I think it's four or five other pilots that shot down jets that day. My brother was the first, and these four of them that shot jets. And there's a picture, and here's a picture of my brother up in the corner being the first. I got that picture through my son.
Well, and that's what I was alluding to, because you and your son did a phenomenal job sharing this story with the students at Fresno Christian School, and I was there to listen to all of that. And your son Scott said, here you guys are at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., looking at an ME-262, that German jet. Your brother shot down one of those planes in World War II. And so your son texts his cousin, who he's never met, and your cousin fires back with that article that you're talking about. So there's proof and verification. That seems pretty surreal to be standing in that place and get that on the smartphone at that point.
It is. It is surreal. How it happens, I don't know. But you know what? The communications are so fast today that it's mind-boggling. I'm a dinosaur when it comes to communications.
And I allude to that experience with the ME-262 and your brother's legacy. But I'm sure that wasn't the only time you thought about your brother on that trip. You're with all these other veterans as part of Central Valley Honor Flight, but the main destination was the World War II Memorial. When you looked at that wall of gold stars representing over 400,000 Americans who didn't come home, and knowing that your brother was one of those represented there, what did that feel like? What did that mean to you to be there and see that?
My brother is one of those gold stars. Thank the good Lord, I'm not there. My brother was not as safe as I was, and wasn't granted the life I was, unfortunately. But that's about it. That was a long time ago. That's in the past. So far back, 70 years ago. I still have the love for my brother that I had when he was alive, but it's not the sharp, instant feeling, instantaneous feelings or memories that you have. Not now.
What did that whole honor flight experience mean to you? What did you get out of it?
I got that the people of the United States are just wonderful, wonderful people out of that flight. The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful. They aren't what you hear on the negative sides of the news and TV. People are great. We walked through the airport in Baltimore, and people that are waiting at the gates would come out and applaud and come out and shake our hands and say, thank you for your service. The tears would flow, I tell you. They didn't flow very fast, but man, these people, they don't even know us. And here are 67 of us with our guardians and our staff going through this airport. And it was from here to Save Mart that we had to walk. It was a heck of a long distance to get to our buses. The people were just fantastic. And then our first stop was in Baltimore. And in Baltimore, the Post 40 of the American Legion put on a barbecue dinner for us. Well, they had a man put the barbecue dinner on. He had 11 barbecue restaurants in Baltimore. Well, after the American Legion goes through their rigmarole, their rituals, and introduce everybody, we have our dinner, and they introduce him. And he comes up, and he says he has 11 restaurants. We're going to 14 more. But he says, I'll tell you, without you, you gentlemen, you 67 people, we would be speaking Japanese and German. He says, I'll tell you what I do. Every day at noon, I close my restaurants, including my kitchens, and play the national anthem. Well, now, when that greet you, the first thing you get off the plane and have dinner, and someone tells you that, you know it's an upper. And then we get to the hotel that night, and then the next day we go to the World War II Museum, where our three congressmen are there, and it's vacation time, and the kids are all over, and people are all over. Scott and I were sitting, and a father came up to us. He had his three kids, and he said, "Would you take a picture of my kids with another guy and I, sitting there?" "Yeah, sure." So the kids came. They put their arms around us, and they took our picture. And the people were just so warm and so friendly. We were walking. We walked as a group. And there were school kids in going from one memorial to another, and they were all lined, and you could see their guardians holding them over. They break ranks. The kids would break ranks and come over, and they would hug us and thank us. Just absolutely. They wouldn't stay there. They wanted to thank us and shake our hands. Kids, 8, 9, 10, 12 years old. And this happened all over Washington, no matter where we were. We were greeted as though we were something special. The smiles and the happiness of theirs and their thanks. But a strange thing happened personally. First generation American. Parents are from Poland. Well, at the changing the guard at the Arlington Cemetery, the sergeant major says they dedicate a wreath. Well, the day that we were there, they dedicated the wreath to their Polish defenders. Well, that's good. My ancestors. Yeah. So then the next day we're walking from the Vietnam to the Korean memorials. And this lady comes out of the crowd. They did quite frequently, but she came out and she grabbed my hands. And she shook and she said, "I got to thank you for saving my country. I'm here from Latvia." Well, the coincidental thing is my mother was born in Riga, Latvia.
How about that?
No, if you didn't, someone wasn't guiding her to come see me out of all 67 of those guys. Why me? Because my mother was born in Riga, Latvia.
I think if folks have been paying close attention to your story from start to finish, they're sensing a lot of those moments here. Your orders get changed. You end up in Fresno. You meet your wife. You're sleeping instead of in your office when the gunman comes in. Right down the line, it does seem like a lot of things lined up. And you've mentioned that you feel it's God, and you've mentioned your faith that you share with your wife. But you haven't mentioned how long it took you to figure all that out. And this is a story that your son helped share at that event that I got to be a part of. How do you tell that story of how you came to the faith that you have now?
Well, I was reared a Roman Catholic. I was an altar boy. I sang Gounod's Ave Maria in the 1939 Midnight Mass. But I always had a question. Not quite a doubting Thomas, but I questioned, well, who was Jesus Christ? I questioned that, and I did practically all of my life. I knew God controlled everything, but I wasn't sure about Jesus. Well, Scott is an ordained minister and very, very, very strict Christian, but he doesn't try to force that on us at all. My son Scott, he doesn't try to force it on. We're very close to Scott. I am. He's my best friend. Anyhow, he didn't do it. No one did it. But one morning, I'm 75 years old. I woke up one morning. Someone touched me. Nothing untoward or spectacular happened. I just woke up and realized the only way to heaven or to eternal life is through Jesus Christ. It just struck me. And I can tell you, it changed my life. And Maxine will agree, it changed me. Why it happened, I have no idea, but God touched me. When he's ready, that's what I say. I'd like to know what day it is in that book when he's going to take me. But I really don't. But our day is written, and when he wants us, he'll take us. I don't worry about it.
I can tell you're having too much fun. Why worry, huh?
I'm having a ball. We came back from World War II. We didn't expect anything. We expected all we wanted to do was just go out and do our job, get a job and go to work. That's all we felt. We didn't expect anything from anyone. And now, 70 years later, we're getting the honor flight.
Yeah, is there anything else you want to say about that? Because I'm sure, you know, you might run into a neighbor who's a veteran and says, is that thing for real? Should I really think about going on that, or is that some kind of racket? How do you answer a question like that?
Well, as far as I am concerned, the honor flight is about one of the best honorable recognitions given to World War II veterans right now. Every World War II veteran should go. If he gets the opportunity, he should look into it. Because they find that the people of the United States do respect what we did in World War II. And it shows in Washington, D.C. That flight made me realize that the people of the United States are just a whole group of great, great, great people.
Well, people like you set a really great example. Jack Leonard, 94 years young. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. I know that story has a few chapters yet to be written. Don't forget to check out the photos of Jack and Maxine on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or on hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for now. I hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.